All right, welcome to the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber, the cricket podcast where we answer your questions. You can support us by super chats if you happen to be live in the YouTube. But if you can't hang around for live YouTubes and you want to ask a question anyway, the best way to do that is via Patreon. So patreon.com/ Good Areas Podcasts, and you can ask questions like Addy has, who says, I know you don't like the mega auctions with only 5 player retentions because of the lack of player team fan connectivity. I do think the limit on retentions is the only reason the IPL is remotely competitive each year. What's not remotely competitive each year? Because the same teams keep winning it anyway. If Boomer and Sky can be convinced to take 16 crore on paper with everything else being paid under the table, imagine how much more foul play would happen and subsequently stack the teams. Yeah, the thing here is, Addy, what you're saying is that the league is run incorrectly and that their own salary caps aren't actually enforced. And so the mega auction enforces something that they could actually enforce in other ways. Plenty of other leagues in the world manage to enforce these things correctly. Plenty of major sides, that try and pay players under the table and everything else, get caught and everything else. So I get your point, but what you're really saying is that they're not controlling it any other way. So they're controlling it this way, which doesn't control it anyway, because the main star is still staying with the teams. It's just not for me. I just don't think it's the best system. Also, in a league that's developing, the mega auction is a fine way early on. Well, 16, 17 years in, like, this is either a league or it's not a league at a certain point. And so for me, it's a no. Neuron says, what is the worst looking test 100 you have ever seen? Where the batter never looked at any form. My top 10 would be 5 from Elgar and 5 from Karuna Ratna. There's a Rory Burns one I remember at Edgbaston, which I do remember at the time thinking to myself, my God, that's, I can't believe that one's worked. Sam Robson made one where I don't know how Sarunga Lakmal didn't get him out forever. Did he bowl 24 dot balls to him at one stage and he just couldn't hit him. Just couldn't hit him at all. Those ones really stick out. I mean, there's a lot of sort of attacking, lucky, sledgy, not sledgy, a sloggy ones that I'm sure I have seen, especially tail end ones where someone's got away with it. I'm trying to think of one specifically that comes to mind. But yeah, I mean, there are lucky hundreds. There are streaky hundreds. There are hundreds where the players never quite inform all the way through. One of my favorite stories, I think I've got all the people involved. It was Victoria versus South Australia. And they went to Adelaide and a guy called John Scholes, who went on to coach Victoria, made 100 and Jamie Siddons made a 40 odd. And afterwards, Don Bradman came into the change room to chat to the guys. And he went up to John Scholes. He said, that young Jamie Siddons, he moves well. He's a really good bat. That was a great innings. And John Scholes is like, yeah. And Bradman turns to Scholes and goes, you struggled a bit. And it was like John Scholes didn't even make that many first class hundreds. But Bradman was right. But that's not the way that most people would look at those things. It does happen. Ali says, why would BBL intentionally cash with Australian Test Summer and dilute their T20 product by excluding their main star cricketers? I explained this the other day, Ali, on another podcast, and I don't know if you heard it, so I will just briefly go back into it again. But essentially, Australia only has 2 major months of cricket. It's a really weird cricket market. December and January are massive. So what I thought they could have done is left that as the international window, started the BBL in late January, early February, and then played it until the 2 main football codes, rugby league and Aussie rules start in March, March/April, right, around that period, which would have given them a good run at a window that actually isn't that full on when you look at it, when you look at Australian Australian sport, I should say. Like, you run in a little bit to the Australian Open tennis, and then preseason football, don't get me wrong, there's going to be a little bit there, but I thought that was a good way of doing it. Their retort was kind of twofold, I would say, when I talked to them about this, which was they said, we want families to be able to come, which is fair, and it's harder to do that on a weeknight than it is in the school holidays, which is December, January. And then the second bit that they said was that they just didn't think that the product was going to be strong enough to start outside of it. I don't know what to, I don't know whether I 100% agree with that, but it does sort of tell you the way that they think about these things. So for me, it's not, it's from a position of weakness. But what it's done really from an Australian perspective is it's put them in a bit of a slot where, as you said, they don't have their best players available. So why is that is that a good thing for them? Probably not in the long run, right? They've got this whole league where they don't have their most famous players playing in it. Like, no one would ever set up a league like that. Secondly, it's probably also a bit awkward now because of when everyone else is playing their leagues. That if they moved it to late January into early March, they would have got a position where they would be up against the PSL, but they wouldn't be up against SA20, ILT20, what else am I missing? BPL. Is that it? It feels like there's about eight more that I'm missing. I mean, New Zealand, but New Zealand's probably not going to take many players off Australia. So from a league perspective, I think they're behind, but that's why they're doing it. Shriram says, what's the point of finding spotting uncapped talents in India for the IPL if they keep these mega auction cycles for once every 3 to 4 years? Teams that don't care about upcoming players and will only pick established non-risky players. Scouts that identified unknown talents become less beneficial. Yeah, I agree. Sure, I couldn't agree more. I think one of the great things about sport is, you know, look, I'm a Denver Nuggets fan. We drafted this random guy in the second round that we thought was going to be quite handy, who might come over and was a shooting big man and could pass the ball around a little bit. First year, they didn't even bring him to the States to play, kept playing in Europe. Then comes over and eventually takes over the team. And there's that development of where he was drafted and everything else. And, you know, who saw stuff in him that other teams didn't. And it's a really great story, all right? And it's a story that couldn't happen in the IPL at the moment. There's a 13, 14-year-old. I mean, he might be slightly older than that realistically, but let's say he's 13, 14, 15, whatever he is. And he might be their next big star, but they're paying him one crore and he might not play in this cycle. So then at the end of that cycle, they have to then think about whether he should be playing straight after that, right? And so they're going to have to make a decision on retaining someone who might not have played yet. And they're right. They're the ones who've drafted him. So, but you get the other way, whereas there might need to be some age limits on drafting players as well into the future, which is another argument. But yeah, I think it's a bit of an issue. A lot of this is because the IPL is new and it's trying all these different things, but there are some things in sport that I think work very well. And if you look at the drafting system in the American sports, if you look at the academy systems within football, it's nice. The player gets signed to you quite early. You develop them. You turn them into the kind of player you want. And then you get a chance to play them at senior level when they're fully matured. It feels like that's taken away from us in this league. And that's one of my big issues is that if you get a bunch of good young players, you can't keep them. And I just, it really just bothers me as a sports fan. And Naveen says, setting aside the outcome of the first BGT test, how do you interpret Washington Sundar being chosen over Ashwin and Jadeja? Prior to the New Zealand series, Sundar wasn't even in contention, yet he seems to have leapfrogged Ashwin, Jadeja, Kuldeep, and Akshar. Is this decision purely based on current form, and does the management view him as a long-term mainstay? I'm not sure at the moment. I haven't really talked to anyone in the Indian setup about why it happened. I assumed he was coming in because they wanted the tall off-spinner, and they wanted the better batting. So he kind of beat Ashwin and Jadeja on the two different things that he offered. And so he was coming in. Now I'm looking at it and I talked to Saurabh on TalkSport and it was like, it's actually quite hard to drop him for the next test match because they might have to make two or three changes anyway, right? And so that makes it four changes from a winning side. Even if you're strengthening the side, that feels like not exactly what you want to be able to do. So I think there's an issue there with the way that we're looking at all those sorts of things. However, I think if they had lost that, it's funny that you say no one was talking about. We got a lot of questions on it. Even when India was massively in front, people were really like, oh, if we made a mistake, how are we going to spin our way to victory and everything else? So I do think there was a bit of an issue there. I'd be surprised. I think he kind of has to play in the next test, but I'd be surprised if we don't see Ashwin and Jadeja later on. It's a good situation to be. I think form is right, but I also think that whoever spotted it, you know, I've been talking him up for a long time, but someone obviously spotted that maturity that I was talking about from all-rounders that has happened. And whoever did it, congrats to them, and they've pulled off a great one there. Josh has a hypothetical. Through a contrived set of circumstances of mass player injury and illness, you, Jared Kimber, are having to bowl the last over of the 2026 T20 World Cup final between India and Australia. India need 30 runs to win off the last over with Kohli and Plant batting. What is your strategy? Shoulder injury. Hamstring injury. There's no way I would be able to defend 30 off to Plant. I was almost hit for six sixes in and over by a left-hander. Actually, I'm probably a lot better bowler now. But when I went up against a really top player years ago when I was young and coming through, I went up against a left-hander and I didn't have the game. I'm a better bowler to left-handers now, but he would be able to pick my wrong and so, and my wrong and is with my current shoulder, just not any good. My best chance would be to slide a couple past. And whether he could pick that or not, I don't know. But that's the pace that I bowl is so slow compared to professionals. It'd be very hard for me to be able to do it. Kohli, I mean, I have more of a chance against Kohli just because I'm spinning the ball away. But again, I don't actually think I have a huge chance to do it against Kohli either. So there's certainly... I would probably, let's say Plant's on strike. I would bowl the fastest leg spinner I could, spinning back into the stumps first ball, and I would be expecting him to hit that for six on the hope that the next ball I would be able to slide across the face of the bowlers, of the bat, and then be able to do that. But that's kind of my one trick gone. So, you know, with Kohli, I don't even know if that trick would particularly work. It works a little bit better with left-handers because of the angle. So I'm bowling very, very wide to Rishabh Pant, and I'm probably trying to just mix it up between, you know, leg spin and sliding it on and trying to keep it as full as possible. But yeah, there's no way I'd be able to defend. You can name almost any professional players who can hit sixes should be able to score really quickly against a club bowler like me. The only thing I would say is I probably might get a wicket because they're going for 30, right? And so if I get a wicket, if I get one miss hit where they hit it straight up in the air rather than hitting it anywhere else, and I've got out very good players before when they're trying to slog me, and I'm a leg spinner, so I do have dip on it. And maybe the one advantage I might have is that I bowl very slow compared to professional bowlers, and the pace of my bowling you know, could put them off, if that makes sense. But realistically, most professionals at that level should be able to score 30 runs off me without too many problems, I would think. Unless they can't play spin and, you know, I've got a bit of an advantage. Yeah. Cam says, with the WPL having removed the I as the Indian, should they also remove any caps on international players? No, I don't think you need to necessarily have your, you know, the Big Bash doesn't have the word Australia in it, does it? So I don't think that really matters. I think in the men's game, I would definitely take the cap off players. I think that the IPL, it should just remain the IPL, but it doesn't need a cap. And there'll still be Indian teenagers being given contracts. That's not going to be an issue. I think with the women's one, I wouldn't do that just yet. That league is still developing. And, you know, maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, it might even go past the men's league as far as, you know, how the Indian women develop because there's so much money coming in. But you need 6 to 8 teams and probably 5 to 6 years of constant professionalism before I would worry about that. Oh, my God, what's this? Panda Cyborg, of course it is, says, often heard growing up that one of the great reasons Hamish Marshall got selected for internationals despite his underwhelming record was because he was able to save an extra 10 to 20 runs in the field at cover. Is there any metric that exists to actually measure this? And if not, how would something like this be determined? It's a very hard one. We know that through misfields and everything else, that if you look at it, I think the best fielders are worth about +4 in a game. But what you are looking at there is misfields and potentially when there should be two, a player cutting it down to one on occasion. The best way to do that, Panda Cyborg, would be to have spatial tracking cameras above the ground where you can measure the ball. And so when the ball is hit so far from where the fielder is starting off from, we would expect 2 runs to be run, you know, or 1.8 runs, whatever it may be, right, when the ball is hit there. And should be able to tell that. Whether it's 10 to 20 runs is the thing we just don't know. We know that when John C. Rhodes is at point, or Ricky Ponting's at point, and Michael Clark's at point, and these sorts of players, that they are more likely to get runouts or to stop players even taking the runs in the first place. And that's the thing that we need to get to. We did this a while back. Me and Sid Monger were at a game, and we compared ourselves to the Cricviz fielding stats that they were putting out. And they had Pakistan as like -4 or -8 in a game, and me and Sid had them as -20 in the field. It's so subjective, right? And we were at the ground, and their analyst wasn't at the ground. So at the ground, you can see angles. So a lot of the fielding stats are done, you know, by Cricviz and by, I think there's a few other companies that do them now, are not done from the ground. So you can't see the angles that the field. So there was one that Cricviz didn't mark Pakistan down at all, but it was because we could see at the ground that the Pakistan fielders, I think it was a fine leg and a deep square, or I can't remember what it was now, but there were two fielders out. And neither of them moved for a ball that if either of them had moved for, there was a catching potential. But because neither of them moved, they ended up the team ended up running 3 or whatever it was, or maybe even trickled for a boundary. Whereas actually, if either of them had picked it up and just run off, it was an easy save, and it should have either been a catching chance or a 2. And you can't always see that, so it's really tough to give you that best answer at the moment. But spatial tracking is the way that we will have to do this in the future, and then we'll be able to tell, okay, so the ball moved at this speed towards the right of this fielder, and you know, in general times that should only be a single, but this fielder regularly allows 2, and that's how we start to get to it. Whether it's 10 or 20 runs though, it just seems like a lot to me in a day's play. Oh, actually, we'll take a quick break here from the Cyborg and everyone else. I'm Jared Kimber, and this is The Wagon Wheel. As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year, and I loved every part of it, except for one. This little evil pin here, because I needed this to change my SIM card. And when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies, but even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, or one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, or one word, at checkout, and travel like a pro with Sally. All right, welcome back to Wag Wheel. Sorry for anyone who wanted to come over on YouTube, but the first 10 minutes sort of got eaten, and we're not sure why, but we should be back on YouTube now. Sean says, what is your opinion on current TV overlays, as in the score on the batter and the bowler, etc.? Are there any changes that you think should be made in general, or any information that should be on there that shouldn't be? I really like having the over so far. I don't know when that started to become mainstream all around the world, but I find that absolutely brilliant. I wish the speed was up for longer. I also think now, and I think we could do this. I would like to know, maybe length pitched would be another one that I would like. Speed length pitched would be something else. I don't think you can do line as easily. I think that would be a bit tricky, but you can certainly say what length the ball pitched. I wonder if there is a way of also showing the last 5 balls of a batter who's on strike. But you don't want it to be too cluttered. You know, the 101 is the one that probably makes the least amount of sense. And they kind of backed themselves into a corner with that and decided that it's really good and the rest of us don't really get it. I can't think of anything else. But yeah, if you guys can come up with anything, feel free. But yeah, those are the things that I think as a, you know, fan, I kind of want more information on. Josh says, if you could pick one to have for your IPL franchise, who would you pick between Bumrah and Narine? Bumrah, he's about 5 years younger, isn't he? I mean, if you're talking about them at their absolute apex, I think I would pick Narine at his absolute apex. Although, did his batting and his bowling ever truly overlap? If you could pick the best of his batting and the best of his bowling, I think you would definitely have him over Bumrah. But whether those things actually ever happened, I'd have to go back and check the numbers. My memory is that that wasn't quite the case. Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at it from just purely an analytical point of view, if you're looking at it purely from an analytical point of view, Bumrah can only bowl 24 balls. Let's say he is worth, he is, in those balls, he is 50% worth more than anyone else. So let's say he's a, like a plus 36, right, to your team. I'm not talking about runs or wickets or anything, but I'm just saying in the scheme of the game, he gets you 12 balls up on any opposition team. If Narine can bat 10 balls and bowl 24 balls, then even if his batting is only 20% better than what you would expect, and it's probably going to be more because of strike rate, and his bowling is maybe not as many wickets, but economical, you probably analytically go with Narine, I think, in that situation. But you're also then looking at what is available in the rest of the market, right? Like, is this a market where Malinga exists as well? And if Malinga exists, then I have a natural replacement for Bumrah. And if there's no natural replacement for Narine in that, you know, scenario. Adi says, given how many Indians migrate and take over the tech and engineering jobs around the world, shown by the crowds in any away Indian series, I reckon this would be the same if the BCCI opened up the gates and let Indians play in the CPL Big Bash. I see so many crowd in these leagues, and the cynic in me thinks the BCCI doesn't want other boards to make any money, thus the gatekeeping. I think the original thought process was fair and valid, which was, we want to run the best league in the world, and we don't want our players being available in all the other leagues. Like, if you want to watch the best Indian players in the world, you have to watch this. These days, it doesn't matter. Right, the IPL is so much. The IPL is like 12 times bigger than the second biggest league, right? But I mean, I always look at the WNBA as an example of this. The WNBA is obviously the best women's basketball league in the world, but I can watch the majority of the best players play in Russia or China, right? And there is, and you will hear even women's basketball fans bring this up as a thing sometimes. And sometimes the best WNBA players the best women's basketball players don't always play in the WNBA, although that's more to do with the actual pay brackets and everything else. But if the idea is to develop these players, the Indian players and everything else, I think there's a huge market for talent development through the other leagues. And India is completely missing out on that. Maybe it doesn't matter, right? I don't know, but if it was me, if I was the general manager of Indian cricket, I'd be thinking to myself, I want this guy to play in this league because I want him to get better at this. And I want this guy to play in this league because for his IPL team, he can't play that role, but we can actually sell him to another team in that role. But I don't think they'll ever open it up 100%, right? As in the BCCI. What I think will happen, Addy, is that all these other Indian billionaires who've bought these teams have bought them on the thoughts that they will one day be able to have Indian stars in some of those leagues. There might be a cap, there might be a system, there might be, you know, however we it ends up. But there will be a time when Indian players will play in other leagues, will be my guess. Might be, what, one other league that you can play in? But I just, as the owners take over, that's just what they're going to want. Adi says, very, very unlikely, but with the reaction, what will the reaction be in Australia if they lose 5-0? If India get a bit lucky with the conditions in the day-night test, is there a real chance that India go 2-0 up? Yeah, definitely. And I see 5-0, not too much of a stretch from it. I think 5-0 is still a big stretch from there, but yeah, I get your point. Australian cricket will blow up. It will be a bigger reaction than when they lost the 10-11 Ashes at home. There will be many different reports made. We will be told that they have lost because they did not sledge hard enough and that they're not aggressive enough, despite the fact that they won 2 World Cups and a World Test Championship. That will be completely forgotten. They'll be soft. Pat Cummins will be told he's soft. But it will be a complete review of cricket from the bottom to the top if that happens. I think even if India win this series pretty convincingly, so 3-1, 4-1, even 3-2, you know, any sorts of results like that, I wonder if there's going to be a bit of a reaction anyway. But yeah, if it's a massive victory, so 4-1, 5-0, 4-0, 3-0, I think there'll be a review of Australian cricket. I actually think Australian cricket's probably due a review anyway. See, I think the problem with these cricket boards is they only kind of do it when they have like something goes wrong, whereas actually you should be setting up a review for every 3 years anyway and going, what's not working? Like at the moment, Sheffield Shield is not producing batters, right? I know they know that, but does it really take losing to India and losing to the West Indies to come to that decision? Like we kind of knew that already, right? Sometimes you just, you don't need to wait to lose. And that's always been, that was always my biggest issue with working with cricket teams is sometimes as working with a cricket team, you actually want the team to lose so you can get them to make the decision that they should have made anyway. And it's such a stupid thing because of course you don't want your team to lose. You want them to win. That's why you're working for them, right? But trying to get it through to some people, it's like, oh, well, we won anyway. It's like, you won anyway, but you did the wrong thing. Let's win anyway when we're making all the right decisions. It's a really hard thing to sell to a lot of these organisations. Ruja says, Ricky Ponting had a series in Australia versus India in 11-12 in which he looked back to his best and scored hundreds for fun, but retired a year later after falling over against a callous outswinger. Does Kohli's 100 mean he will score 500 runs in the series and be awful soon after? So what ageing does, Ruja, is it robs the best players of their seal, of their floor, their consistency, but not always of their ceiling. So you're talking about that one. Ponting has admitted now that he was finished when he was playing around that period, and yet still had the ability to make a bunch of runs in that series. And I've talked to a lot of players who played on a little bit too long about it, and they always say the same thing. They felt, because on some days they could go out and do what they did, they felt like they deserved another shot. But looking back on it, they realized that they could still do what they did at their best, but on the other days they were a liability. And that's what happens to those players. You give Ponting and Kohli another chance because Ponting and Kohli, if they do find 2 or 3 years of that form, you're not going to be able to replace that. There's no other player who can replace that if they do come back. The issue with Ponting and Kohli is they look like they have very similar patterns where they have a 6 or 7 year period where they are untouchable. But before that, it took them a while to ramp up to it. And then after it, they do drop off quite a bit. If that's the case, then there is a bit of an issue there with Kohli. Ben says, I know you've said previously that Jadeja would be number one pick in a test draft, not taking age into consideration. If age was a consideration, who'd be your top three picks in a test match draft today? Jaiswal? Probably not Cameron Green anymore, is it? Would have been Cameron Green. Jaiswal would be really high up there. Do you take Bumrah anyway? What's Bumrah? Is he 30 or 31? With his injury history, he's 30. I reckon I still take Bumrah. What's Rabada's age? I think he's around the same, isn't he? Maybe slightly younger. He's 29. Yeah, I'll probably take Bumrah over Rabada then, if it's only a year difference between them. And then I've got to take one more. Marco Jansen's interesting to me. Cameron Green is interesting to me. Washington Sundar is interesting to me. Shubman Gill. How old's Rishabh Pant? 27. Rishabh Pant's quite interesting to me as well, actually. And I'm missing someone else who I just had in my head. Ratchan Ravindra is interesting to me. I'm probably going to go with Rishabh Pant. Yeah, so I've got one player who's quite young. I've got three Indians. Wow. I've got one player who's quite young. I've got one player who is the best player in the world at the moment. And I've got another player who is about to hit his peak. And then I would have, and then because Green, I'm not 100% sure on. Ratchan Ravindra, I'm not 100% sure on. Marco Jansen, I could still see how that goes wrong. Who was the other player I mentioned? Washington Sundar, I could still see how that goes wrong. I'm trying to think if there's any other younger players out there. Kusal Mendes. I could still see how I need to see more of Kusal Mendes before I fully commit to him. I don't think I need to see any more from Jaiswal. And Rishabh Pant and Bumrah are fine. That's off the top of my head. I've probably missed a bunch of players there. but off the top of my head, that feels right. Apologies if I miss someone really, really obvious. But those are the ones that definitely, because you wouldn't have Head. And Australia doesn't have an obvious young player coming through. You wouldn't take Stokes. You wouldn't take Root. So that sort of counts out England. There's no one in the West Indies. Yeah, I think I feel relatively confident that I've remembered players at least there. Let me have a break. And while I have that break, I'll come up with the actual players that I should have picked. This is the Wagon Wheel. All right, welcome back. Oh, wait, I've already done that, haven't I? Also, I'm not sure I would have Jadeja as my number one anymore, by the way, I think. India don't. Bloody Bugger says, call it recency bias, but I think there is a good chance that Bumrah will eventually become the GOAT test bowler post-World War II. However, with his action, we have no idea how long he will stay fit. McGrath averages 21 and 124 tests over 14 years. So far, Bumrah has averaged 19 in 41 tests over 6 years. Yeah, so it's the years and the games, isn't it? I think he has a really good chance of it. But the issue isn't with Bumrah, because I have no problem with saying that he is on that trajectory at all. The issue really is, how do you drop a guy that good if he has 2 or 3 years where he averages 25, 26, 27, 28, which are fine averages? That's when the numbers change, bloody. And I think that's I've just seen it too many times with bowlers before, you know. It'd be really interesting here. And I think he's a better bowler than Waqar Yunus. But Waqar Yunus is maybe one of the more interesting ones to have a look at, I would have thought. So Waqar Yunus, let's have a look. Waqar Yunus, so he has in 1 year he averages 17, then he averages 18, then it's 23, 15, 21. Then it's 41, 26, 29, 20, 58. And some of those are from lesser test matches, although most of them are from amount of test matches. So if you look at Waqar Yunus up until the end of 1994, what are we looking at that stage when it's peak Waqar Yunus? And that's what, is that about 6 years, what you said before? And he probably starts a little bit younger, I suppose, there as well. 01 January 2015. Let's just have a look at what Waqar was at that stage. Waqar at that stage was... Nope, got it completely wrong. Let me try that again. Let me put in a date that actually works in. Live stats. 2015. That's why I did it. I went in 1995. My God. Only 20 years out with my dates then. And I've actually slept. So he had 33 test matches in 5-6 years. And he had a bowling average of 19.15. He's ended up with a bowling average of 23.56. And I don't think he's considered now a great, great. Certainly an all-time great, but not like one of the top 5 or 10, which is what he was on his path of. I think Bumrah has more weapons and therefore should be... shouldn't quite have the same kind of thing, but it is worth remembering that this does happen, right? Fast bowlers get injured, they get tired, they have to bowl hurt and all these sorts of things, and it's very hard to drop them. You know, there were some years there where Waqar Yunus probably shouldn't have bowled all that much, right? But had to keep bowling him because he's Waqar Yunus, and that, you know, you're not going to drop him for someone else. So I'm not comparing them as types of bowlers because they're very different kinds of bowlers. But I am comparing them to show that we have seen this kind of pattern happen before. So it's probably, and that's the only thing that slows Bumrah down, is going to be general wear and tear and everything else. I don't think anyone's going to work him out. I think if anything, he should get smarter. He should actually reach a McGrath level, right? Like, I think one of the things that separate McGrath and Sean Pollock is that McGrath just kept adding things and got to a level that Sean Pollock couldn't get to consistently. So when they both got older and slower, and Sean Pollock slowed down a lot and got very stiff in his body, so did McGrath. McGrath was at, it wasn't really possible for McGrath's average to balloon out as much, but there were still times when people could get on top of McGrath. Bumrah's going to have to go through all that, right? And that's probably the big advantage that Sid Barnes had, is that there wasn't anyone around to like work him out, but also Sid Barnes could play as a seamer or as a spinner. So he could kind of switch between whichever mode was working for him on whatever wicket on any day. And he didn't need the extra pace in the way that was quite important for Pollock and Waqar and McGrath and Bumrah, right? You know, those sorts of things change you as a bowler. And it probably didn't matter as much for Barnes, I would have thought. Vivek says, you were discussing, and just to get back to your thing, yeah, but if that doesn't happen and he ends up with an average of under 20, considering he spends a lot of time bowling in India, I I find it hard to know how, and he gets 250 wickets, right? It's about counting stats, you know, and how high we judge them, right? Vivek says, you were discussing a possibility of a 5-test win against Australia on Cricket 8. After looking at the first match, do you think it's a legitimate possibility now? No, but I still don't think New Zealand beating India 3-0 is a legitimate possibility, and that happened. I'm still not sure that Bangladesh beating Pakistan 2-0 was a legitimate possibility. India aren't starting the next test favourite. I've just checked. They're about 2.8 if you want to put some money on them. If they win the next two tests, they will start the final three test favourites. Well, certainly the third test, they would start favourite. It shouldn't be a possibility. I didn't really think Australia could beat India 5-0 either. So it shouldn't be a possibility. It's not a possibility. But based on everything we've seen in Test cricket this year, it will probably happen. Or Australia will win the next four tests. Those are the... I'm really hoping for a great test series, but I almost feel like it could go completely the other way and like one team could dominate from here as well. It's just because this test year doesn't care about our feelings or our emotions, certainly our analysis. Rudra says, have I got that message? Oh, I'll bring that up in a minute. Rudra says, could Sri Lanka have persisted a little bit more with Nuwan Pradeep? He had a hilariously bad bowling average to start and ended up with 70 wickets at 42 after bringing it down a lot. He never had a year in which he averaged under 33, he never had a year in which he averaged under 33, but his last test was 2017. He never had a year. And then I'm a bit confused about that. But anyway, the very next year, bowlers started dominating. Yeah, he basically, I think Surinder Lakmal's record, and I've talked about this before, there's a couple of those Asian seamers who have really comically bad averages who bowl between 2008 and 2017, whereas Surinder Lakmal and Ishant Sharma stayed around. And so they then make their averages look a lot better. And sadly, that is not the case for Ishant Sharma. Who are we talking about? Nuwan Pradeep. I always felt with Nuwan Pradeep that he was a very naturally gifted bowler, but he didn't really know what he was doing. Would he have been able to bowl the wobble ball and had success in that kind of era the way that some of those other guys did? Would he have pitched the ball up further? All the sorts of things that were going on in world cricket. I think that's the fair question with him. Richard says, Boxing Day MCG is the day for exceptionally high attendance for Test cricket. Given this, and I don't think this will happen, even allowing for the madness of cricket in 24, how badly would turnout be affected if India were 3-0 up? A lot of Indians would turn up. There's a lot of Indians in Melbourne. You know, when I grew up, there weren't that many Indian families around where I was. We had a lot of, you know, I grew up in a, you know, real Sri Lankan area. Like almost everyone on my street was Sri Lankan. And I played a lot of cricket with Sri Lankans and Bangladeshis growing up. And there weren't that many Indians. And by the time I left for Australia, it felt like there were so many Indians in Australia. And if you look at some of the World Cup attendances in Australia for Indian games, I just think there's a lot. And I think a lot of people would fly into Melbourne at that stage, although it's not particularly cheap to fly into Melbourne on that day, of course. So even from other places they would come in. I haven't looked at the attendances. I'd be shocked if there's less than 75,000 at Boxing Day, no matter what the scoreline is. But the percentage of Australian fans will go down quite a bit if it's 3-0. I think that's fair. Although Melbourne, it's such an event. If India's 3-0 up, it might be the best thing for the crowd because maybe 55,000 Melbourne fans will come out anyway. It's still Boxing Day, right? There have been some bad Boxing Days before as an Australian cricket fan. Maybe you go anyway and then all the Indians turn up, right? I don't know. I haven't been over there in the last 3 or 4 years. And I don't look at the crowd figures as much as I used to when I was traveling, because when you're traveling, you kind of, you know, you're at the grounds and you're having a look at things. When you're on the TV, you kind of tune out of that a little bit. James says, who is Sri Lanka's second best ever test seamer? Most wickets are Lakmal. Malinga and Fernando have the best averages. And then you've got Fernando, Rajitha, and then the other Fernando. I would say at the moment, I was a big fan of Malinga. Oh, sorry. He's saying most wickets are Lakmal, Malinga, and Fernando. But the best averages are Asitha, Fernando, and Rajitha. It should be Asitha, Fernando, based on everything I've seen of him at the moment. I think Malinga's record in Test cricket is actually worse than it should be. I saw him bowl in Australia when he was really young, and I thought he was really good. I thought he could have become a really good Test bowler. Lakmal probably should be the person that I would give it to at the moment. when Lakmal worked out test bowling, I know we just said that pitches changed and the wobble ball changed and the actual ball changed and everything else. But I just thought Lakmal just got so much. I just thought he was a really good bowler in that period. But I would give it to him at the moment and then would Asitha Fernando, based on everything I've seen at the moment, should take over that mantle. Or any one of a number of bowlers coming through. Ben says, if an IPL owner came to you and said, Jared, I do not care about the next 4 years. We can use every game for 4 years. I don't care. But on the fifth year, I want you to have the team that guarantees we win the IPL and starts a dynasty. What types of moves would you be making? So that's a really hard question, Ben, because the mega auction. So that's if you came to me as a owner and you said that in other leagues, I'd be like, great. I know exactly what we need to do. I know what we need to overpay for a bunch of younger talent that we think is worth it. And we need to develop them 12 months of the year round and get them ready. How you do it there is it's the Delhi conundrum from the last cycle, right? The previous cycle. Not the one that just went, the one before that, I should say. Where they kind of tried to do this and they invested in younger players and then they couldn't quite keep them around the way that they wanted to. So I'm not sure there is a great way of doing this, Ben. But yeah, if that's what you're going to do, you would instantly spend a lot of money in your scouting. You would start looking at players from around overseas players from around the world who are, you know, 15 to 18 that are coming through and looking for those, you know, that you everyone knew about Marco Jansen, right? Well beforehand, you would draft him or get him in the auction or whatever that may be and that sort of thing. So there's a few players like that around the world. You have to also be prepared. Your ownership has to be prepared that you're going to get some players who are just never going to come through at all. And you're probably going to overpay those players. But then you invest all your money in developmental coaches. So you work out who the best ground level coaches are. So, you know, batting coaches, bowling coaches, whatever, you know, you're looking for people like Roddy Eswick from the West Indies, but bunches of guys like that who are incredible at developing younger players, around the world and in India specifically. You go on, you host as many scouting trips to as many different parts of India as is humanly possible in those 4 years as well. That's kind of what you would do. But whether that would work or not, I don't know, because it's the way that the retention, that's why I don't, that's one of the reasons. Anyway, Jake says, Bumrah's IPL salary of 18 crore feels very low given Pant and Iyer have gone for about 50% more. What's the deal there? If Mumbai retain him, there's not much he can do. I don't think you have to worry about how much Jasprit Bumrah is being paid. I don't know what he is getting paid, but it ain't 18 crore, which is part of the issue with the entire league as it is structured, that we end up spending all this time looking at the auction and really the players who are retained get a lot more than is said on their balance anyway. He would be getting considerably more than that, which is part of the issue, right? It doesn't really make sense. The better way of doing it, that's why the auction is a bit of a pain. Yeah, I wouldn't do it this way. I like the two draft systems, gives them an extra chance of getting more interest. And the free agency thing means that we can talk about the IPL from the end of the season to the start of the next season. There's always going to be free agency talk, right? I just think that's a much better way of doing it. But yeah, he's getting more than 18 crore. No one believes he's getting that money, that much. Adityan says, we can consistently see India not bringing the field up to stop singles when bowling to the tail with the batter at the other end. Is that not something that they have overlooked since they have been doing it quite a bit? Do you know what the thought process is? Well, all teams do this. There's not a team in the world that doesn't do this. The idea being that you just want to bowl to the player who is not set, or is not very good, obviously, as well. The issue, and this, how long has this been going on for now? The first time I remember really being angry at it, I think, was Mike Hussey and Glenn McGrath and South Africa just let them make runs for ages. And white ball cricket has changed this a little bit. But I just think even if Mitchell Starc is batting well, surely bowling to Mitchell Starc with a decent field. I'm not saying you don't have a couple of players out, but do you need the players everywhere out? I don't think it really works the way you think it works. And then if you're going to do it, I think you have to fully commit to it. And then by that, I mean, you need to bowl four balls where you're trying to take the top order guy or top order or the set batter, however you want to put it, it's wicket. And then the last two balls have to be head high bounces, right? If you're going to get off strike, fine. You're going to have to get off strike playing a shot to a bouncer and we're going to have the field out set We're going to have the catches out for the bouncer. If you want to get a single playing a hook shot, we're going to have a fine leg and a deep backward square and a deep third in so that we still think we've got a chance there. And they don't seem to do that either, right? You have to make it very hard. Or what's another way of doing it? Bowling really wide outside of off stump. A length ball really wide outside off stump with four slips, gully, backward point, cover point, whatever, and saying, you have to be able to do that. I just feel they make the last runs too easy, the last couple of balls too easy. So if you're going to do it right. But I think in a situation where you have a Taylor under the other end, even if they're Mitchell Starc and they're batting well, I just think you bowl to dismiss them rather than the way that teams go about it. It's very different when you have a batter who's a destructive batter. It reminds me a lot of tactics in other sports that become mainstream and there isn't really a way to disprove them. And so it's a bit like punting in football, in the NFL, sorry. It's a bit like fouling at the end of NBA games or basketball games. We kind of know these things don't work, and yet we still continue to do them. I do think now that players are so good at playing attacking shots, it's harder than ever before. But I think teams just go too quickly on all the fielders on the boundary style of it. Some of it is about controlling the game as well. If you look at the Mitchell Starc, Josh Hazlewood thing, they didn't really get away Australia. So I understand it, but I don't know. It's not for me. Sean says, did the introduction of third umpire for runouts change how players run between the wickets, similar to how DRS has changed LBWs? No, I can't think of a reason why it would have, Sean. I mean, you're much more likely to get a good decision now than before, but I can't imagine there's a reason why it should have changed. I would say the only other thing that I would add to that is that the white ball revolution, even if it did have a change, it would be so minute compared to the white ball revolution and the fitness revolution, the professionalism revolution. Those are the things that have really changed run outs. I think that's probably fair to say. All right. I might just take the super chats straight up. Anurag says, thoughts on Lehman's comment on Root that he must score 100 in Australia, else he won't be regarded as an all-time great and lower than other Fab Four members. That's probably not true, is it? There's holes in lots of great players. Like, does that mean that Shane Warne's not considered a great because he doesn't have a very good bowling average in India? Like, there's a lot of players that have a record like that. Ricky Ponting's average in India is 26. Does that mean that Darren Lehman, and he's got 100, but from, God, like a lot of test matches too, isn't it? From 14 test matches, 100. Does that mean that Ricky Ponting's not a great in Darren Lehman's system? And I haven't heard Lehman's comments. I'm just going up on the back of what you've said here. Where is he? Root has 14 games. And he averages 36. So he averages more in Australia than Ponting does, but without the 100. So are we just saying then straight away I don't think that's the case. I think if you go through records of great players, as I have been doing a lot, you realize that there are blips, there are matchups, there are, whatever it may be for a lot of great players. And it is what separates that sort of Tendulkar-like player, Gavaskar, Steve Smith level players, right? That there aren't any blips. So that's why they're slightly lower. But Kane Williamson has heaps of holes in his career, right? That's just someone who hasn't really done the maths and is just has a bit of an axe to grind, would be my guess. Although he shouldn't, because he would have a relationship with Root, I would have thought, through Yorkshire and everything. So maybe I'm wrong, but yeah, I'm not. I wouldn't worry too much about that. Tesla says, NT. What's NT? NT currency. Now I'm more interested. It says New Taiwan. Is that New Taiwan dollars? Hello. Anyway, Tessia says, South Africa makes World Test Championship final. Is that good or bad for Test cricket? Seems like there isn't an easy answer, or is there? No, there is not an easy answer, Tessia, because they basically gave up Test cricket in the middle of the cycle, right? So it's kind of cool that it's not the obvious sides coming in. But it's also horrendous that a team who went, nah, it's not for us. We don't care about Test cricket. Wait a minute. I don't think that's a good thing. But I also like the fact that I like the fact the bowling team's done it. So there is an element of that. But no, I do like the fact that they've been playing such good cricket and put themselves in a position to do it. And well done to the players and everything else. But I don't know what that says. It says exactly what we've all said. This is such a flawed, silly system. But hey, let's just roll with it. Edda says, why was Australia so bad in ODIs after 2015 to 2019? Was that the period where I started saying that they were just resting and rotating all the times? And I can't remember is that the period when they stopped playing their best players consistently, especially their best bowling attack? I would have to go back and have a look at exactly what they did. But yeah, I've got a feeling they weren't taking bilaterals all that seriously. And then even up to the 2019 World Cup, I don't think they had realized, if we're being honest, how much the game had changed. So I think there was a bit of an issue where they weren't playing the game. They kept mocking England. I remember this, especially privately when you chat to them. I was like, guys, look, I get it. It's England and, you know, it's not for you, but I can tell you that this is the real deal. And it felt to me that they weren't quite engaging with that. There was a lot of rest and rotation. So Hazelwood, they basically decided that he wasn't in their best players in that format. I want to say as well, I'm trying to think if they experimented a lot with a bunch of players that didn't quite come off. I'm trying to work out how many games they actually played in that period would be really interesting as well, whether that was one of the periods where they stopped playing. I'm trying to remember if that was so they played 99 games and Stark plays in 57, Cummins plays in 51, Hazelwood plays in 38, and Zampa plays in 48. So that's basically your frontline bowling is playing half the time. They probably kept committing to Faulkner for a little while when it was quite clear that he was on his way out. I'm just having a look at their bowling list because I'm a bit more interested in that at the moment. So Faulkner, they kept going back to, despite the fact he was sadly passed. I will do a video on him one day because I think it's a really interesting story. Mitch Marsh bowled a lot at that stage. You know, they invested a lot in Stoinis as well, especially as a bowler, and Maxwell as a bowler. So I think there's probably more to do with all of those. Not having strong enough bowling attacks is what I remember. I can't remember what they did with the batting, but I remember thinking quite a lot that they didn't always have the bowling that they needed. Oh, I'm on my own today, Noah. So finding your question in the comment is maybe not quite as easy as it would normally be. Let's see if I can quickly do it. There we go. How is KKR? They're good. Nokia Spencer in place of Stark, QDK Gobars for Salt. Rest remains the same from last season. How important would captaincy miss of Shreyas be? Of Spencer and Alice, who would be better in the IPL? I like Alice, but I think Spencer has a higher ceiling at the moment. Let me just have a look at KKR. I really like I really like Salt, but he's gone to another side. But what I meant was I really liked Salt as a player, so that's not ideal for them. Let me just quickly have a look at them. I like Spencer Johnson. I like Moeen Ali because I think he fits the kind of player. I think he's maybe beyond his best, but he can come in for a couple of games, hopefully. Who else have they got? Vaibhav Arora. I didn't mind that as a signing. Obviously, overpay on Venki, but I'm okay with that. I'm team Venki. With Nokia, you're kind of hoping for him to come back 100%, and they've got Rovman as well. Yeah, I still really like them. I still think that I don't want to say near certain finalists because I think I've got about three near certain finalists, but I see them as a team that should certainly be in the top five without too many issues there. Divya Javin says, God, I've got something in my eye. Sorry, everyone. Can you recall what your initial assessment of Gill and Shaw was as they were prodigies? And is what way was Besto different to what they were? My initial thoughts on both of them is that they were, A-grade talents. Prithvi Shaw still picks the ball up as well as anyone I've ever seen. I think he has some issues with the way he bats, but his actual, the way he picks the ball up is as clean as anyone in world cricket. He obviously has issues with his professionalism, his attitude and other things. But at that stage, I didn't know too much about that. So the first thing I noticed was the ball striking ability and everything else. So I rated him really highly. Shubman Gill, I'm trying to remember when Shubman Gill really came on my radar. I'm assuming it was IPL. I just remember thinking that he had a very repeatable technique. That was my thing with Shubman Gill. And so I thought he was a very classical player with a very repeatable technique, so that not a lot could go wrong with him. Bairstow, was I there right at the start of Bairstow's career? I suppose I probably was. I thought Bairstow hit the ball in the air too much when he was younger at catchable heights, and he got away with it for a little while, and then it regressed. And then we realized quite quickly that if you bowl the ball on the stumps consistently to Bairstow, you're going to get him out. And nothing has really changed there with Bairstow. So he doesn't get caught as much as he used to, but bowling LBW is always going to be an issue for him if you're bowling full and straight at him. He just has days where that doesn't matter, right? He has days where he's just on another level. So I would never have had him ranked close to those other guys, although I did like his early first-class numbers. And also there was a year when I think he got dropped and he went back to first-class cricket and just dominated. Really, that to me said that he's international quality, but he does have this sort of flaw within him. Apiosh says, appreciation for Jared, which covering the post-test starts at 2 in the UK. Not 2, Apiosh. 2:15. No, 2:20. I didn't even get the time right. My alarm was set for 2:50. I've been walking around like a zombie for 5 hours of sleep while you've been releasing bangers after bangers. It was really, I must admit, that's the worst time zone for me. I've said this before. The Bangladesh tests are the ones that I just can't even do Bangladesh. I remember I did it for Test Match Sofa once and it really ruined me. I don't mind the 4 and 5 a.m. starts. So Adelaide test is better for me. Indian tests work quite well. Pakistan tests can work quite well. Sri Lanka as well. Those I can kind of work my life around. And the overnights, while they're hard, you just have to flip everything. So I can deal with that. The 2:15 is like the worst of all cases. And I did struggle quite a bit. I think the first day really enthused me. I remember the second day waking up and just being like, and watching that first session and just being like, oh my God, can something just hit a bunch of sixes, Mitchell Starc, or get out? Those are your options. Like there was some anger from me there. And obviously we've got the Morning Glory show partly because I just have to keep, it's really hard. I tried to sleep on day one during lunch break and I didn't sleep a minute. So, yeah, it's tough, but it's the job, mate. It's the job of what I'm doing. The day four, was it day four or day three? One of those days I did an awful amount of work. Like I wrote an entire feature. And I must have done, 5 or 6 different other recordings throughout the day. That was a big, big day. But, you know, when I used to work for Cricinfo, when I first started for Cricinfo, I would quite often write a feature from the ground and do the two chucks, which I edited and filmed and performed in. And I would quite regularly have, 5 hours of sleep each night and no social life and just be working all the rest of the hours. I'm used to doing that, but thank you very much for noticing and the very nice super chat, Piyush. ABCD says, do you see a dip in the future for Root like Smith and Kohli? He does have a weakness to in-swing seaming deliveries that could become worse with age. Yeah, any weakness you have could become worse with age. So yes, I think he has the most repeatable of those four guys, in that he's so good at getting off strike. He's the best at getting off strike of those four players. And as an older player, that is such a good... If he can keep on to that, I would say he should tail off less than everyone else. I've done a video on it, actually. That's the one thing I think he can hold up. But yeah, he should... The other thing is, if you're really good against spin like he is, Amol Desai did a whole thing that actually sometimes playing against spin is the thing that deteriorates the quickest rather than paying pace, which doesn't make any sense when you think about it. But when you start to understand why that might be the case, you're not moving as quickly and as you were when you were younger, whereas you're reacting to fast bowling where you have to be slightly more proactive to spin. Because he's so good against spin bowling, and that's a huge part of his game, if there's going to be, you're talking about the seam bowling, but it could be this, the spin bowling that actually causes him some issues, and then he just becomes an average player against pace, and then we have a similar sort of decline. I mean, everyone should decline, right? Singmut says, should Afghanistan be included in the World Test Championship? In my opinion, they are better than 3 or 4 of the current test playing teams. Also, what changes would you make? I'd make a million changes. I can't answer that one, Sigma. The World Test Championship should be 7 teams in Division 1, 7 teams in Division 2, 7 teams in Division 3. And Afghanistan should be fighting for a chance to be promoted into Division 1. That's how it should work. And, you know, hopefully one day it is how it will work. The scene uploader. I don't know if this is another one where I have to find it. I can't find anything there. But thank you very much for your super chat. You're certainly on the screen. Soham says, where are we? This has started similar to the 2017 Border Gavaskar when India doctored the pitch and they lost by 300 runs. Did they lose by that much? Oh my God. Second test was also extreme conditions, like Adelaide will be. KL opened there, made 140 runs. Who will be Australia's KL? Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. You're right. It probably is quite similar. I mean, to be honest, I think the Perth curator was trying to make it a better pitch and somehow made it a worse pitch. So well done to him. But yeah, you're right. The next one will be probably quite extreme. That Bengaluru test was really, really interesting. That was a great test series. It's probably one of the best test series I've ever covered. If we get anything like that, I'm more than happy. Who will be Australia's KL rule? Well, I mean, this can't be Marnus, can it? Can it be McSweeney? Like, I'm trying to think of narratively who it would be, like where KL was at that point. Is it Carey? It's not Carey. Could be Carey. I don't know. Sigma says, is England really the saviors of Test cricket by not coming close to qualify for any final? What should they do? They're just pathetically overconfident. They don't even try and get in the World Test Championship final, Sigma, which is this is the really weird thing. They're going on and on about morals and saving Test cricket and making it entertaining. Mind you, like, let me just read out. This is, I put this up on Blue Sky today, and I think that you can find it on my Instagram as well. Probably find it everywhere. I can't remember where I put it, but it's in lots of different places. Let me just read this out. Nope, that's the wrong thing. So 2024, Australia beat New Zealand, who beat India, who beat England, who beat Sri Lanka, who beat New Zealand, who beat South Africa, who beat Bangladesh, who beat Pakistan, who beat England. Right? Now, if the West Indies and India win their current series, and I don't know, let's just say England beat New Zealand as well, because it makes it even more fun. India beat Australia, who beat New Zealand, who beat India, who beat England, who beat Sri Lanka, who beat New Zealand, who beat South Africa, who beat the West Indies, who beat Bangladesh, who beat Pakistan, who beat England, who beat New Zealand. Like, England isn't saving anything. This is just happening, right? It's really interesting that, you know, and some of that is inspired by the baseball stuff, but some of that is just like, some of the cricket hasn't been very baseballian at all, right? It's just, cricket is wild at the moment. Test cricket is as entertaining as it has ever been in my life. There's so many different narratives and everything else. But it's really interesting, just to get back to your question, that England are the one team that don't seem to be bothered by the World Test Championship at all. Even South Africa had one eye on it. I think they thought they might lose that series to New Zealand anyway. Right? But England have been like really clear that they don't care about it. It's like, the party's here. I put a tweet out recently about, you know, when India lost in New Zealand and what that meant to the World Test Championship. And like these England fans going, I don't know why you care about that. It's like everyone cares about it except for you at the moment. Like it's actually been a fairly successful, it's been a fairly successful tournament or whatever, as far as this particular one has got some interest. Lots of fans from around the world are paying far more interested in it than they have before. So it's weird that the one team who could have been involved, doesn't want to be involved. Ikan says, would you rather be a worldie for 2 years or consistent but average / above average performer for 10? I suppose I would rather be a worldie for 2 years because then I would know that I got to the peak. And if I'm at the other one, I'd probably know I'm at my peak, but not the peak. Would be the best way of answering that. Ikant, I think. Ikant says, what are your favorite intros? Could be written or video, could be yours or someone else's, could be non-cricketing, world is your oyster. Punch Drunk Love has this incredible opening to that movie, which is still one of my favorite openings of all time. I think you can find it on YouTube. I think people have broken it down before. I remember watching that movie and just being like, my God, what have I just seen at the opening of this movie? The Wild Bunch. There's a scene where the Wild Bunch are coming into a town, and there's a there's a bunch of kids who have pulled a scorpion on top of a bunch of ants. So it's a bunch of ants trying to take down a scorpion. It's such a brilliant explanation of what that movie is going to be, and a beautiful, visceral. It's probably against all animal cruelty rules, I would have thought. Now, I mean, it looks realistic. It doesn't look like it certainly wasn't CGI, but it doesn't look like it was a prop or anything. I could be wrong, but it looks real. You wouldn't be able to do it, but those two, instantly, the opening scene of the opening chapter of the book Dice Man is incredible. Again, in modern life, I don't think you could even write that anymore. I don't know if that book's been cancelled or whatever, but that opening chapter is so, it just sears it into your brain. I don't know if there's any particular, if there's a piece that I've written that where an opening stands out. I know what my best pieces are, but I'm not sure if there's like a particular one in the opening that makes sense from that perspective. I could be wrong though. I could be wrong, but I can't think of one where I'm just like, oh yeah, that's the great opening. There might be. Did I do a Mitchell Johnson one when he was in Adelaide? That might be something along the lines of, it's almost like a Tool song or a scene from Game of Thrones or something. That might be one where the opening was really, really strong. The Aubrey Faulkner one, the Asif Kareem, actually I can't remember the Asif Kareem opening. So the Aubrey Faulkner piece that I wrote, the one about Archie, the Afghanistani who moved to Kansas, those two openings I think are really, really strong, and I remember spending a lot of time on them. But yeah, those are the ones off the top of my head anyway. That's it. That is me done for today. Thank you for everyone for showing up. Oh, wait. Soham says, can really be the bowler, Evan, can be the bowler's Evan Gulbis this series. So it's slightly different the way that it works with that. What you really want from Reddy is for him to be the Shane Watson. I think that's a really good position for him to be in for India. If they can get the Shane Watson overs out of him, that works well for them. I'd be happy with that. You've got four frontline bowlers around him, and you've got Shane Watson overs. You'd take that anytime. I think I still think they'd be in a better situation if Hardik was bowling for them. But without Hardik, and Reddy's batting might be more test available or test ready at the moment anyway. I certainly back his batting a lot more. I don't have any issue with that at all. It probably depends on whether Washington can handle bowling in Australia consistently, which is the other thing. Because you don't want Reddy to be your fourth best bowler. You want him to be your fifth best bowler. And then the Watto overs are perfect for him. That's it for me here on the Wagon Wheel. Sorry for the opening on YouTube. Don't know what happened there. Didn't sync across or something along those lines. But thank you to everyone for coming into the chats and everything else. I'm Jared Kimber. This is the Wagon Wheel. Got so much content on the main site, so much other content. If you haven't seen it yet or heard it yet, I'm not sure it's out on video yet, but if you haven't had a chance, the podcast I did with Himanosh Ganju, former Indian analyst, and my weird role in that and his weird job within the Indian side, definitely worth having a look at that. And there's a bunch of other stuff to come on this channel and on the other channel and on all the channels. We're everywhere. Wherever. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help.
And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.